So today I will just discuss a story that I'm quite interested in these days, which relates to the physics of the cosmological particle production. And we're trying to see if we can use more like a position space search to look for this the signals of this process. So the talk will mainly based on the paper we put out on the archive a few months ago with my awesome collaborators, Jonghwan Kim, who was a postdoc at Notre Dame and now is faculty in the Chung-Po University in Korea. Shobhit Kumar, he is now a postdoc at Berkeley. And Adam Martin is another faculty in Notre Dame. So in this story, we are trying to see if we can probe extremely heavy particles. I would define what do I mean extremely heavy using the inflationary dynamics and cosmological signals. So that's the main thing we want to look at. And the particle detector we are going to use in this talk is the CMB map. Okay. So I think in this crowd, I don't need to introduce what is CMB and everything. So. But just as a quick reminder, usually when we're trying to get some physics out of the CMB map from all this random fluctuating hot and cold spot, is to calculate the endpoint functions. Okay, so we calculate two-point function, three-point function, higher endpoint functions for the temperature fluctuation. So it's kind of doing some statistics, looking at the feature happens everywhere in the sky. Okay? So when we look at the temperature power spectrum as a function of the different L modes, while the large L correspond to the smaller structure, smaller hot and cold spot in position space, and lower L is the fluctuation for the larger structure on the CMB map, we can kind of see what's the size of the perturbation for different sides of the structure. Okay. For the structure that enters the horizon before recombination, we know there are this later process, the baryon-acoustic oscillations that can further process my primordial perturbation to generate all these nice peaks. For the mode that was remain super horizon at the time, you can see that the perturbation is pretty much flat. Okay, and maybe many have a little bit correction from the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. So this tells us that the primordial perturbation, and actually even with this perturbation got processed by baryon-acoustic oscillation, is still pretty much of the same order of magnitude, basically. Okay. So this again tells us that the feature that we see on the CMB is basically a scale invariant, like a white noise kind of feature. So it makes perfect sense to calculate endpoint functions and do some statistics and try to get some physics out from it. Okay. So this is the usual way that we look at CMB. And using this, people actually already discuss a lot. There's a long history on thinking about how to use this endpoint function analysis and use the behavior of inflation to study very heavy particles that produce at early time. Okay. And more recent effort, lots of it's a very active field now, is called the Cosmological Collider Physics Program. And there, people consider if you have some new particle with a mass comparing to the Hubble scale during inflation with some coupling to the inferton, you can induce three-point functions or higher endpoint functions of the inferton fluctuation. And that will leave a signatures on the kind of non-Gaussian signatures of the temperature fluctuation for the CMB. And using this, if we do see such signals, then we can have a chance to probe this heavy particle comparable to the Hubble scale mass, and which is already a very high energy because it can be as high as 10 to 13 GeV. So we are getting close to approach the Gauss scale. So that's very nice. Okay. But of course, this type of signal usually carries a separation, an exponential separation, with the ratio of the particle mass divided by basically the energy scale we can use to generate a particle, but I'm going to come back to this point later. So you can see that if I have a mass to be much higher than the Hubble scale, then this won't work well. The signal would be exponentially suppressed, okay? So there is always this a very interesting question people are trying to ask to find examples on, is it possible that we can push this limit of the mass to be much larger than the Hubble scale? In that case, is there a chance that we can still produce the signals and produce heavy particles? Okay. So there are already examples on the cosmological collider physics, like using some chemical potential tricks that we can still generate signal. But the thing I'm going to talk about today is a little bit different, which is that it turns out if we have the heavy particle that couples to inferton, we do have a chance to generate some heavy field, much larger, heavier than Hubble scale. Okay. Later, I will mention this earlier works again, like this very nice paper from, I think, all of the authors were at Stanford at the time, were discussing this type of scenario. And there are also a local work from people at PI and trying to use endpoint function analysis and trying to study the signal. Okay. So I'm going to mention this signal again, but the basic idea is you want to push the mass limit to higher, to be much higher than the Hubble scale. But even before getting to mass, we can kind of imagine what would happen if I keep pushing the mass up, right? Because first of all, I have this exponential suppression. This is going to give us that we won't be able to produce this feature of changing the perturbation everywhere in the sky. Okay, so eventually I will only be able to produce few of these particles. And so I'm going to look at something, some signature that is very localized in position space. Okay. But at the same time, when the mass is larger, the mass has a chance to source a large curvature perturbation locally on this different position in the sky. So this will end up generating a localized signatures on the CMB map in position space instead of like changing the physics everywhere on the map. Okay. So the signal we will be looking at is a parity produced hotspot pairs on the CMB map. And don't worry, later I will show you a more realistic, like a numerical simulation of the signal, but this is just a cartoon picture. To give you the idea. So then the question is that if we do have a signal like this, would the endpoint function still be the best way to look for the signal? I mean, can it even be like now we should zoom in and look at some profile, fit some template and trying to find the signal in position space? Maybe that would be a more efficient way to look for such signals. So that's also the thing that we want to discuss. Okay. So if that's the way that we want to look at a signal, like in position space, this would be a very different way of thinking and for the signal and the background and these kind of things. But of course, when I have this signal, localized signals, they will still introduce a correction to the power spectrum with a very specific scale. So later, that's why in the later part of the talk, I'll also come back to the power spectrum a bit. Okay, but for the position space search, I like to think this is a bit more like collider analysis. Now we look at a map, it looks like some jet with some profile, and then we want to trim and clean up the map and trying to identify the signal. So that would be the way we do the search. Before I start talking about the signal, I need to mention that the reason I started to look into this thing was actually motivated by a very different paper that's written by Honda Madasena, who was trying to imagine there's some possibility that we have some signals in the sky that we can do a Bell's inequality experiment in the sky to figure out if the CMB comes from have a quantum origin or is classical. So there they were talking about, he was trying to talk about this parity produced hotspot pairs, but he didn't very careful calculation and trying to do a phenomenology study. So that's a thing that gets me into quite interesting on this kind of thing and want to make it more realistic. Okay, so that's just a part of the introduction. And then now the structure of the talk is very simple. I'm going to just walk you through step by step on how would the heavy particle being produced during inflation time, and then how does it end up giving the signal that I was mentioning. Okay, and then after that, I will talk about some signal phenomenology of how to look for a signal. Okay, so let's start from the non-adiabatic particle production. Okay, so again, please stop me whenever every time you have questions. So in order to write down a concrete example that we can do a calculation and do some estimates, let me just focus on a toy model. When I have a field, a scalar field sigma, that carries a potential and has a mass term that couples to the inflaton wave. Okay, so that's the assumption that I make here. So in this case, I can calculate what's the potential of the sigma, and the potential will now depend on the inflaton wave. Okay, so this would mean that the sigma mass will vary in time. Okay. It doesn't really matter what's the exact form of the sigma. I mean, it can have just one local minimum or have a few local minimum. But in the whole analysis, let me just zoom in and focus on the case where I just have one local minimum in mass. So at the time, let me call it the eta star. Okay, this is the co-moving time. It's just the time or the distance. And you can think about distance also, horizon size. It's just at this time, the sigma just gets its minimum mass. So the dominant production of the sigma will happen at this time, okay? Because otherwise it will be exponentially suppressed for larger mass, okay? Any questions? No, okay. So, and then we are going to assume even for the minimum mass of the sigma, the mass is much higher than the Hubble. During inflation, because we want to look for heavy particles. Okay. So now, because the dominant production is really around the minimum mass, so I can write down the potential, and later, if I want, I can also do an expansion of the mass around the minimum point in time. Okay, but here, let me just assume that the sigma field has a coupling, the phi field, with the coupling constant to be the G. So throughout the talk, the G will be the coupling between sigma and the phi, the inflaton. Okay. So with this phi-dependent mass, now, first of all, this is also the mass term that they're studying one of the examples in the Frogger paper I mentioned before. And the difference is they have a periodic potential, but we have one potential, one minimum. And they look at the endpoint function analysis. Okay, so that's the main difference. But later I will come back to some result of the endpoint function analysis as a comparison, okay, in the very end of the talk. Okay, so now I have a potential. I can write down the equation of motion of the sigma field. And so it will look like this, just a Hubble damping term, some momentum, and then some time-dependent mass that carries this usual eta square, one of the eta square form, because we are in the De Sitter space, like expanding universe, okay? Inflationary universe. The main difference is now the mass term of the particle is also time dependent, okay? So I can rewrite the whole thing into a harmonic oscillator for the equation of motion, and just a harmonic oscillator with a time dependent frequency. That's it, okay? Now, how does this tell us about the particle production, okay? So, different from collider physics, like we calculate particle production with a well-defined vacuum, like a zero temperature vacuum well-defined, we can use Feynman rules. But for this business, my vacuum keeps changing because my potential of the sigma keeps changing in time, okay? So the way to describe a particle production is this using the Bogoliubov transformation. And the idea is the following, okay? So pardon me, I know there are experts on this kind of thing in the audience. So pardon me, it's just two slides thing. Let me just explain the idea of this non-adiabatic production. Okay. So I show you that equation of motion that I have. So in the initial time, let me call as a minus infinity as the initial time. It's just the convention for inflationary physics, okay? I have the potential in the beginning, and I can solve the ground state of that potential, and that will define my vacuum. Okay. At a later time, my potential changes, so my wave function solution also changes. So now if I use the new ground state to define the vacuum will not be different, okay? And there is a relation between my initial ground state to the later state. So it would be some combination of ground state and the new excited states. So what that tells us is that if I stay in the original vacuum at time zero or minus infinity, if this potential changes quick enough at a later time, I can fall in onto the excited states at a later time with a non-zero particle in vacuum. So that's basically the idea. Okay, but for the real calculation, what we need to do is to do the usual second quantization, and then based on the field at a different time, field solution at different time, I do the A and A Dagger trick. Okay, so what this gives us is
we'll end up. Sorry to interrupt. Can I ask a very naive question? In my mind, it makes sense that if you start out with a sort of with a high mass, and then you lower the mass, that the thing that was the high mass ground state in some sense has energy to spare and then becomes a tower of states with a lower mass potential. But is the opposite also true, that if the mass were to increase, like in the cartoon, the mass naively looks like it's getting bigger?
Right.
Does that also give rise to a tower of excited states?
So first of all, the energy conservation to think about is not really from the energy or heavier mass go to the lower mass. The energy is the thing, is actually coming from the inferton energy that changes the potential of the phi. So you have a source of the energy that keeps doing this. Okay, so you don't need to worry about heavier go to lighter and things like that. Okay. And as you said, it's true. Yeah, so if I have a potential changes in time, even the mass increase, yeah, so I can. Yeah, I can
okay. do the thing. Okay, fair enough. Okay. Cool, thank you.
So then this just, so the so-called Bogoliubov transformation is just to say that my initial creation annihilation operators has a relation to be the final creation annihilation operators with this linear combination, okay? So later, at a later time, if I want to calculate the number density of particles, what I can do is I can use the later time number density operator, it's a BB Dagger, and act on my initial vacuum if I'm in the Heisenberg picture. And now the result will not be zero because I do have an A Dagger here and A here, I give a non-zero result. And the result will be proportional to the square of this beta factor there, okay? There's a standard way of calculating this beta. I don't want to get into this lengthy calculation, although I prepared two slides, but I mean, you can come back. I'm happy to share slides. The only thing I want to say is that the calculation is straightforward. Okay, you solve the equation of motion, write down some whatever complicated solution of your field, and you put it in the initial condition saying that I want my oscillation to start from only a positive frequency mode. This is just a choice, okay? I choose positive frequency mode at the initial time, and that will fix my solution. And now I look at my solution at the later time, I begin to show that the negative frequency mode shows up because the positive and negative frequency mode correspond to a kind of positive and negative energy mode that relates to the raising and lowering operator. This prefactor of the opposite sign frequency mode directly relates to that beta factor that's for the mixing of the creation and annihilation operators. So this is literally how you can solve the field equation and then extract the beta. And then you do the momentum integral that gives you the number density of particles, Okay, so it's just a standard calculation. Okay, so now I'll come back to our signal again. So once I have the number density, I can estimate the total number of hotspots in the sky that is relevant to the CMB signal. So to do that, I can just multiply the number density to the shell of the recombination or the light scattering surface, which carries the thickness of the shell roughly a few percent of the radius. Okay. So then that gives me the total number of new particles being produced. Okay. And it looks like a complicated solution, but you can try to understand the solution in the following way. So first of all, this exponential suppression is very similar to the one that I showed you in the beginning of the talk. So this basically says that if my mass is much larger than this G phi dot term, I have a very small chance to produce a particle. But if it's opposite, I have a good chance to produce them, okay? This is actually just what I told you about the potential, because the G phi dot is basically the change, gives you the change of the potential of the mass because of the inflaton rolling. And the M is basically the frequency of the oscillation. So you can imagine that if the oscillation is much slower than the change of the potential, then I have a very good chance to produce the particles. If it's the opposite, then I will just keep following the true vacuum, then I don't have a chance to produce new particles. So that's basically what this exponential factor tells us, okay? So it comes from all those number density calculation. The rest part of it, well, there's a prefactor you need to do a calculation and you get a solution, okay? So I have nothing more to say about those. But the rest part of it is just a volume. It is just a volume of the shell of the thing, okay? So now that's, first of all, any questions so far?
What's K star?
Oh, sorry. The K star is the, right, is the inverse of horizon size. So the K star over KCMB is really the eta star over the co-moving time, the CMB. So the cubic of that is actually the volume that we'll be considering. But we only consider a shell of the volume because this is where all the imprints of the things on CMB would be. So that's why I multiply this ratio here. Okay. Okay, so now let's plug in some numbers. So because from the CMB measurement, and also if we assume the usual slow roll way of generating a perturbation, this phi dot, we know what's the number of it be, okay? It's 60 times of the Hubble. And by the way, in the expression, I end up getting a dimensionless quantity because I can divide all the energy dimensionful quantity to the comparing to the Hubble scale. So that's the thing that we can put in all the numbers, okay? Okay, so let's just work out and put one example, okay? Let me assume that the coupling between the sigma and the infraton is 5, or just putting a number by hand, but throughout the talk, we'll talk about the order one size of the coupling anyway. And let's assume that the minimum mass of the sigma field is about 300 times of the Hubble, okay? And let's also assume that the horizon size when the particle being produced during inflation is 100 megaparsecond. And to think about this, this is basically chop the CMB by 1,000 by 1,000. And then that's the size of the horizon we are looking at. And if you plug this in, you get the number about 1,000 of the heavy particles that you can produce in this volume. Okay. Of course, we need to worry a bit because if we do produce too many of those, we are going to destroy the slow roll motion. Okay, so we need to make sure we satisfy some of the bound. Okay, so for example, because I do put in an extra term on my inflaton potential, so I need to make sure this extra contribution to the potential is always much smaller than the kinetic energy of the inflaton. Okay, so that I don't do any damage. OK. Okay. So if we work through the algebra, this will end up setting a bounds on the upper bounds on the number of particles that I can produce as a function of the coupling. And then you can plot it, okay? So from that back reaction constraint, if we don't want to have more than 1% correction to the inferton potential compared to the kinetic energy of the inferton, we need to stay below this green curve here, okay? So that would mean that if I can produce certain number of particles, like a 10,000, or I mean, this line will correspond to about 1 million particles, I need to make sure my particle, we need to stay above this line. The particle needs to be heavy enough so I don't produce too many of them to and cause troubles, okay? And also there's a similar constraint that one can, we derive. I mean, you can check the paper to make sure that the sigma field doesn't drain too much energy from the slow roll kinetic energy. And there you will also get a similar bound, okay? So Curry, you look.
I should be quiet. Sorry.
No, David, go ahead.
I mean, what's the ultimately the sort of classic cosmological collider physics picture is one where you just make a lot of these. So how does that look to this picture?
Yes, and that's right. I would say so. Yeah, so that's the limit when you keep lowering the mass. And then you don't rely on this energy scale like a phi dot to produce them. You actually use the H star. You can already source the particles, and that's the usual thing that people
do. I see.
But there's a couple, of course, people design a different potentials and also coupling to the kinetic term of the kinetic energy of the inferton and also do those things. But I mean the simplest version of that would be that's the main difference.
So in normal collider physics, I still produce this thing. It's extra. So this is my ignorance about cosmological.
Physics. So there would be the 3-point function, for example, the right. Correlation of a 3-point function yes. would right. be larger than the uncorrelated fluctuation.
So this is just a really different production mechanism. You have sort of naively speaking, inferton decay into these things, as opposed to like in some sense, Bogoliubov production kind of thing.
Like well, for those, it's also a Bogoliubov production. I mean, for the cosmological collider, it's the same mechanism. Mm-hmm. So, it's just a thing that on the denominator, on power of the exponential is different. It's just an energy scale. Yeah,
it's just a different way of calculating the same effect on the CMB in some sense.
Right. Of course, for that, people already have a more advanced way of doing that. I mean, they don't go from this zero step that I show you already. They are already, you can calculate diagrams, there are Feynman rules that you can use to calculate those.
I'm trying to understand the sort of fundamental, is it just, are you just in the low statistics limit of the exact same calculation or?
Yes, I think there's a transition from this to there. I mean, if we keep lowering the energy, but also there are people care more about what's the endpoint function of the inferton fluctuation being sourced by those new particles running inside the loop. And here I'm talking about the producer particles on shell and then directly seeing the signal of the particle. So in that sense, it's different.
I see. So it is different.
But the physics behind, I think, is very similar.
So does that mean that filling the sky with on-shell productions of these particles is just not allowed, according to this logic, or is it just that this calculation of this process breaks down in that regime?
No, I think it's it's allowed up to the point when I have too many of those and then violate some bounds.
Okay, so this is a real bound, not just a breakdown of approximation. It's a real bound on the on-shell production.
Oh, right. This is a bound from not a...
Yeah. as opposed to
slow roll motion, and of course the consistency, because we do assume the slow roll just behaves as it is when we kick our signal.
As opposed to a different mechanism that leaves its imprint in the classical cosmological collider physics calculation, the effect of these particles in these on-shell loops, kind of thing.
Right.
Okay. Great. Awesome. Thank you.
And then I will talk about the signal calculation.
There's just a quick comment in response to what David said. The reason why there is a stronger back constraint here is because Yushin is taking the energy from the kinetic energy of the photon, whereas normally in cosmological colliders you'd say you're taking it from the vacuum energy. Maybe I mean it's a little more fuzzy, but the vacuum energy is much larger than the kinetic energy. And so that's why. And it's also much more efficient way of producing particles than the cosmo collider approach.
I see.
That's right. That's actually a good improvement. Yeah, here it's kind of a special case. Because we really rely on coupling to the infraton to do this trick, because the infraton that changes the mass and source and non-linear wave production. For the lower mass, we can also just use the energy in the background, the Hubble, to do that. And then there, the bond will be different. It's not this.
I see. Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Anson. It's nice.
Hi, Anson.
Remind me of time at Maryland. okay. But of course, there's still a tuning issue, which is that since I'm looking at put the order one coupling between infraton and the sigma field. So if we really want to think about the UV complete model, we need to also deal with this UV sensitive diagram that will show up. But I'm going to take a bottom up approach by saying there are ways. I believe there are ways to solve this. For example, like in that Frager paper in the appendix, they give one example that they supersymmetrize the sigma field. So you can deal with that. But I'm more curious about what's the ability of the data that can tell us how many spots that we can have in the sky. Okay, so I'm going to ignore this tuning natural mass issue. So far I keep using a word like parity produced hotspot, but I actually didn't explain like why do they need to produce in pairs. And I'm also not going to explain detail here, but you can actually work it out just from the momentum conservation. It's also not a surprise. You can write the A and A Dagger and then calculate the amplitude, and you will see you do need the particles to show up in pairs to balance the momentum. Okay. A more non-trivial question is, what's the separation between the particles? And this thing is actually confuses us a lot. And I still don't think we exactly know how to kick a probability function, but we know how it look like, okay? So first of all, there are two contributions of the separation. One is that when you first produce a particle within the horizon, they don't need to stay at the same point, okay? And actually, because of the momentum that we have, it's usually very low. Otherwise, we have exponential separation. So that's why when we produce these states, we usually produce them in a very low momentum state. And then in that case, you can compare the momentum to the scale of the horizon size, and you will see the particle can basically be produced everywhere inside the horizon, okay? They actually cannot be produced initially getting too close. The probability will be suppressed because the momentum doesn't want to go too high, okay? So there is this initial separation. And later when you produce a particle, if they carry the finite momentum, they can further move, okay? But what we found is that this motion must give you a few percent of the horizon size distance. So we can basically ignore that the later motion of the particle after the production. Okay. So when we try to estimate the signal, we are going to assume the signal happens everywhere inside the horizon with a uniform probability of the separation. Okay. So now we have particles being produced in pairs, but what does that do to the signal? Okay. So the signal is going to the mass is going to modify the curvature in the horizon and leave a signature. Okay. When I talk about perturbation, for now, I will use a lot of the word curvature perturbation, and this is just a combination of the energy perturbation, the gravity perturbation, because the redshift effect should be taken into account for the final result. But it's just a way to call up perturbation, and this quantity is gauge invariant and also can allow us to compare directly what's the primordial perturbation to the perturbation that we see today. So when the particle was just produced in some initial time eta star, it will change the curvature perturbation in the horizon. Okay, because we are still in the inflation era, so this old horizon will leave. Will leave, and now we came to a new horizon, but with a different curvature perturbation because the mass of the sigma field keeps changing. Okay. So once I repeat this process again and again, after all the modes enters horizon again, I look back, what I will have is away from the center of the hotspot, I'm going to have some radial profile of the curvature perturbation away from the center because the mass is a bit differently at each time when my mode leaves the horizon. Okay. And again, there is a way, textbook way, we can calculate this. Okay. So we have, since the mass acts as a source term of the curvature, I can calculate the one-point function of the curvature by using the so-called in-in formalism. Again, just check all these papers and teach us how to do that. So we can calculate the one-point function by expressing the curvature perturbation with some racing a creation and annihilation operator, and then put in all the factors of the age and the phi dot, and ends up writing the solution of the curvature perturbation. Okay, so the solution you will get would contains this factor here, some combination of the Hubble slow roll parameter and Planck. This whole thing together is just that primordial perturbation, like 10 to minus 5 perturbation that we always talk about. Can be measured from a CMB. And all the new physics is encoded in this prefactor in front of it, and depending on the mass, and also depends on the distance away from the center. Okay. So we can expand the mass. We can rewrite that mass term in terms of a function of the radius. Okay, because mass depends on the radius when we look at the distance today. And we have a logarithmic factor here. Okay, so this factor as a ratio of the radius away from the center just directly comes from the dynamics of the inflation. Okay, because what we did is we do expansion of the field around the minimum point in the physical time, and the physical time has this log dependence correspond to the co-moving time because of this exponential expansion stuff, okay? So that's why this result is pretty generic, I would say, unless if the experiment has an extremely high resolution that we can see a very late time, the most that leaves the horizon at a very late time, the linear expansion may fail and it may no longer be a log dependence here, but otherwise it basically just follow this logarithmic dependence of the away from the center. Okay, and of course the result is proportional to g factor here, so you can imagine if a g is 4, then the perturbation you get is about twice of the primordial perturbation roughly. Okay, so now I think I'm differently kind of didn't manage time well, but anyway, I will maybe later as for some part of it, I will jump, but I think it's good to have the discussion more of the signal. So now we're not done yet about what the actual signal look like in the sky, because the thing that we study is still the curvature perturbation given by all these dynamics before they enter the horizon and got corrected by all the sub-horizon physics. Okay, we haven't included that yet. And that's actually a non-trivial thing to do. So I also didn't explain that when I produce this, do I end up having a cold spot or hot spot? Okay, even though I keep saying hot spot, but we don't know. So we need to calculate that. So in fact, if you are looking at the temperature fluctuation given by this curvature fluctuation I talked about before, before the mode enters the horizon during the CMB, you will actually get a negative temperature fluctuation. Sorry, even though you'll get a negative temperature contribution from that curvature, okay? Because it's still a classical thing, right? It's a mass gravitational potential, and it gives you the redshift of the energy. So that's why you end up getting a negative temperature around the spot, okay? But it turns out when we take this and then combine this with the so-called transfer function that takes into account the evolution of the perturbation once we enter the horizon and do a proper integral and map it on the two-dimensional space with the last scattering surface, this cold spot's initial condition actually got converted into hot spot in the end. Okay. Because all this, the way that the Baryon-Kuznets oscillation works changes the perturbation. Okay. So for this different examples with a different horizon size, so the same, you can think the same coupling, same mass of the heavy particle, but it will produce at a different time. And once we include all those effects, we get a different temperature profile. Okay, so some of those, we get the enhancement of the temperature profile. So this is angle away from the center. And some of those, we get a suppressed temperature profile for the mode that enters the horizon for too long. Okay, so depending on what's the time that the heavy particle were produced, I can actually have different patterns of the signals in the sky. Okay. Any questions so far? So this you need to do the calculation. And then if you look at the, here is a plot on the center of the central pixel of the spot. Wait, sorry. It started responding. Now you come back. Okay. It actually, again, depends on what's the horizon size. So for most of the horizon size we are interested in for the CMB search, we get a positive temperature. But if you are really looking at a very, very big chunk of the sky, you will actually also get a cold spot out from it, okay? So there are some relevant, but mildly relevant works that trying to use this kind of physics to explain that anomalously cold spot on the CMB map, but the physics is basically the same. You get a negative temperature if you look at very large horizon size signal. Okay. So.
Spherical or?
Yes, the spot should be spherical because the way the curvature profile go should be symmetrically distributed. I mean, the potential, gravitational potential is okay. Spherical.
How should I understand?
Of course,
how should I understand the ring-like features?
Oh yeah, so that's right. So I don't have a very good way to, like a simple picture to explain this, but you can imagine that when I convolute my result with the density perturbation or the transfer function, the energy fluctuation oscillates up and down with respect to the different K mode, right? Because it's acoustic oscillation, right? So when I go from the K space into the position space, for some of the radius, I got more contribution from one type of perturbation mode than the others. So my final result can indeed have some oscillation in radius. And then it really depends on what's the behavior of the transfer function that matches the horizon size that gives you this fluctuation. So the ring shape is like sometimes I get a negative contribution of the temperature a bit, sometimes I get positive contribution when I again go from momentum space to the position space. So that's why I have some oscillation patterns on it. That's the only thing that I can say now. So it's actually non-trivial. I mean, when Juan Montesena was writing his paper, he had a footnote basically saying this, I don't care what happens. I'm going to call it as a hotspot. But actually he was right. After you do a calculation, he was right about the sign of the temperature. Yeah. Okay. For the rest of the time, I'm going to talk about the signal. But there are definitely more to study in the signal. Even for our paper, we only put a very, very little, a very rough estimate of the signal only. So here I will just sketch out what we have learned and then what can be done in the future, okay? So when we trying to make things more realistic, to design a search for the thing, what we can do is we can simulate a fake CMB background based on the power spectrum that we measured from Planck. And then we can put the signals on top of it, okay? With all the different resolution. This is just a low resolution. And then you can easily see that even with the coupling equals 3, which is a pretty large coupling already, if you see back and forth, I think my connection is bad, so the plot doesn't change. But like you can kind of see there's a bit difference of the signal that shows up from the hotspot. But it's also not much hotter than the spot that I already have on the background. So the interesting thing of this is that it's not that obvious actually to just we can pick up the signal by eye directly. The signal is actually not that big. So we need to put effort in how to dig those things out. But first of all, in principle, if I want to do a real thing, in looking for a signal, and we hope one day we know how to do that. I also need to include the instrumental noise in it. In my image, I need to include the foreground from galaxies and stars that will also be on my CMB map. I need to be able to subtract those so that I can do a position space search. But we think there's a chance we can do that. And actually, even when Planck was analyzing the data, they did a lot of those by subtracting compact objects because the energy spectrum of these objects are usually very different from the black body radiation. So to a certain level, we can identify those and using a different frequency map and then subtract them to some level, okay? So in principle, there are ways to deal with these backgrounds. The thing that I want to focus on is this, the background from the primordial fluctuation. This is really an intrinsic background, like even with a perfect CMB analysis, it will be there. So I want to see how big the background is, basically. That's the thing we want to learn. Okay. So I'm going to discuss a very naive search. Okay, using some cut and count search, like putting some temperature cut and count the signal and estimate background type of search on the simulated CMB map. Again, I'm going to assume a perfect CMB measurement, only consider the primordial fluctuation And just to be fair, I will only use about 60% of the sky when trying to set the bounds on the number of signals that we can see. Okay. I decide to skip some of the details, but one thing, the screen like moves slower than I want. Okay. But the thing that I want to emphasize is that it's not an easy search, because the background hotspot can actually be very hot compared to our signal. And also, if we look at very hot spot from the background, they actually like to show up in nearby locations, which will be similar to the parity produced hotspot on the CMB map. Okay. For first point, like the background can be very hot. For now, I just want to point to you that if you look at the temperature in position space, the temperature fluctuation is of order 100 microkelvin. Okay. So that would mean that even if my G is of a factor of 8, if G equals 8, I can only have a comparable signal comparing to the CMB fluctuation. So it's never a background free search if I just only use a temperature cut. Let me skip through a few slides, like why does the background also have such a high temperature fluctuation? But if you're interested, I can come back later. And also the thing is that if we look at things in position space and put a high temperature cut, the only chance that the background can show up as a fake signal is that there are several hotspots with a different size of the, with different scales there on top of each other. That's a way to generate a very hot spot above the sea level, kind of like if I put temperature cut. And you can easily say that when that happens, you usually have a higher chance to find another very hot spot also from the background. So it's not easy to just use the fact they show up in pairs to distinguish the signal from background. Okay. But just to get some understanding, get some numbers in mind, let me still do it. So I put the signal on the simulated CMB and put the signal plus background. There are some way that we discussed that can kind of smear out a part of the map and get rid of the lower L mode contribution of the background. Let's skip the detail. But later we just put the temperature cut and then we can identify what's the signal, which will include some fake signals in it. Okay. Then the thing I can do is that I compare the total number of signals I get with the background only scenario, comparing that to the signal plus background scenario, and see for how many signals I put in, I start to see the difference between those. Okay. So again, it's a very naive, I think cosmologists would just walk away from the room when seeing this, and hopefully not. But it still gives us a good some idea about how the background would look like. So just to give you one example, so assuming we are looking at the signal with horizon size to be 160 megaparsec, considering a scenario with G equals 3, and that search, then we will have a 2 sigma difference between no signal and with the signal if I inject more than 270 pairs of hotspot in the sky. Okay, so that's the basic idea. Okay, so if we translate this number into the mass of the heavy particle, the minimal mass of the heavy particle, which is about 200 times of the Hubble, and which is about twice of this energy scale we're comparing to for the non-adiabatic production. Okay. Of course, such a signal would also changes the power spectrum of the CMB. Okay. So that's why we also take the same map and then trying to study what's the correction to the CMB power spectrum. And we get a very L-dependent signals, which correspond to the horizon size of the hotspot. So we have some little bump here. And just to give you an idea that the size of the delta chi-square you can get with the signal away from the lambda CDM assumption it's smaller, it's much smaller than the delta chi-square when Planck using the lambda CDN to do the fit, okay, between the best fit value and the mean. I can come back for more details, but this basically means that this deviation is insignificant to the precision of the we are doing. So it's not as easy as saying that, oh, this is already ruled out by Planck. I mean, we need to do a different analysis for this, okay? So using this very crappy search, I can already put some upper bounds of the number of hotspot pairs I can put in the sky. So with a different number of the horizon size I'm looking at, okay? So if the horizon size is 100 megaparsec-ish, okay, then the bound is around a few hundred, okay? And it's stronger when the coupling is really large, okay? When the horizon size is small, the signal is going to smear out quite a bit by this sub-horizon physics. So that's why the bound becomes worse. In that case, it can be that the power spectrum measurement will actually be a better way to go. But it's hard to quantify this because to really study the CMB, the power spectrum bound, we need to do a numerical study while keeping all the lambda CDN parameters to run. So we didn't do that. So this just to give you some ideas about the signal. And when I translate this number into the mass, it usually corresponds to the order of 200 to 300 times of the Hubble. That's what we can get, again, for this very crappy search. I only have 1 minute left, so, oh, sorry, no, here I do need to, because this thing relates to the paper written from parameters, so I definitely won't need to talk about it, okay? So for all this analysis we are doing, I'm looking at position, doing a major position space search in the sky, okay? And people also thought about the endpoint function analysis that they're trying to dig out this type of signal in a slightly different scenario where they have an oscillating potential so that the hotspot can, in principle, be produced at the several different horizon size, okay? But there is a limit to go back to our result, okay? That's why we can do a comparison. It's hard to quantify their bounds in the one sigma, two sigma way. Sorry, just make sure, is Kendrick here? Probably not. Okay, because uncertainty is not Gaussian for this endpoint function analysis, but they do give a plot, and which we believe we interpret right because we also talked to Maurice a few times about this, is that if you think about the order one coupling in the same scenario, that will correspond to this blue curve here, okay? And then, if you take this as a bound, it's basically they say if this is a case, they have a good chance to constrain it. Then this will correspond to some number density of the hotspot divided by the Hubble volume to be about order one number of the signals. So that's the size number of signal they can constrain. While the number of signal we are talking about here will correspond to 0.1, okay? So it's... Yes.
Do you win very much going from like a WMAP to a Planck?
Good question. I actually think for this very dumb cut and count search, the fact that we are just looking at basically looking at temperature of the pixel with 100 megaparsec size of horizon, I think WMAP and the Planck it doesn't change. Right, because we are not using profile of the signal. So actually when we do analysis, we're actually doing a very low resolution analysis. As you see, it's just a dot here. So we are not, again, using the fact. I will say a few words about the profile thing, but so far this should be exactly the same search, no matter if I use the Planck image or the WMAP image, I would say. And also in their analysis, they do use the WMAP. That's what they claim. Yeah, But I think they also assume the background has been subtracted. So we are working on the same map. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah. So I don't think this gaming comes from the, because we use a different data. But again, I would only say that it looks like the position space search has a good chance to win, but both of the search can be greatly improved. So it's definitely worth looking at the position space search. That's a thing that I think Morris also agree, at least I can quote his words on. I don't have, maybe because I don't want to delay people, maybe I can leave the story of the only few two slides on the using a neural network. So this is using some profile information, trying to map out signal. What we find is it seems to be that we can greatly enhance the efficiency in taking the signal, much, much better. But I can come back to this. So let me just conclude. So here in this talk, I'm talking about the scenario where we can use inflation dynamics to produce very heavy particle and leave very localized signatures that we can see in the sky. And for me, I really think this position space search has a great potential, not only for this one toy model example, but for many different scenarios. For example, you can imagine a scenario that produces signals with several different size and profiles of the localized signals at sky simultaneously. Or it doesn't need to come from a particle production, right? It can be somehow some tunneling effect or some weird effect of the inflation that happens to change the inflation property locally, only a few spots in the sky. And that will also generate some position space signals that in principle one can look at. And besides looking at CMB, there are definitely other signals that we can see, like in the gravitational lensing. Let me just finish in words. Gravitational lensing process. So in that case, I don't need to worry about like a signal being smeared out by the Silk damping effect during the CMB. So maybe there we can get a more clean signals. That's the thing I always want to do, but I just need to learn from basic about how to do all this weak lensing calculation. But I mean, any ideas would be nice and then will count. Okay, so, that's it, yep.
All right, yep. Thank you so much, Yixin. Here's some virtual applause. If we have more questions.
Sorry, let me see if there's a chance I can get back. Yeah, question, please.
Yeah, Matthew.
Hi.
How are you?
How are you doing? Nice to see you.
Very good. How are you?
Very well, thanks. Just to call your attention, about 10 years ago, many of us thought very hard about how to look for things in position space. So there are existing techniques and algorithms that were applied to things like cosmic bubble collisions and textures and strings and all sorts of weird stuff that you definitely don't want to look for in the power spectrum. I would predict that you could make a constraint of G of order one for one thing in the sky if you were to use these techniques. More or less, because we know we can detect spots whose amplitude is about the size of the curvature perturbation. If there's even one of them, more or less. So I think you can improve greatly on the constraint that you have from what you showed us today. So that's promising. You should look into that, I would say, and I'm happy to share some of those things with you as well.
Yeah, definitely. So I will send the email. I do know that, I only checked one paper so far, which relates to that bubble collision thing. It's a paper from Sanatori and just designed some template, but I'm pretty sure they also cited several works. I just haven't got the chance to dig into that. Yeah.
Yeah, so and I mean, there's simpler things you can do too, like match filtering and things like that, that would also get you a long way there. I guess the other thing, like, I mean, some other simple things you can imagine doing, you know, the full endpoint function is kind of overkill, I would say. I mean, really, either you want to like do an imposition space or you know, some not the 1000 point function. You know, one thing you could imagine doing is, and we thought about doing this for bubbles, but we never followed through. You can compute within sort of this halo model. So if you just take the spots and you paint them on the sky, they're clustered. You know, they have some characteristic separation that you've told us from the physics of how the particles are formed. They need to be like a horizon distance away, and they have some profile. And so if you were to compute the particle-particle correlation function, you could compute the correlation function of these smeared out things. Yeah. Mm. So they have a two-point function because they're clustered. And then also there's going to be a contribution just from the fact that within a profile, things are correlated because, you know, it has some shape. And then you can easily compute the three-point function, the four-point function. And probably just analytically, you could write down what the 3-point and 4-point, 2-point, 3-point, 4-point function are, for example. And that could be another way, like instead of, you know, then you might have a bit more of a targeted way of looking for a specific, you know, maybe there's a constraint already from, you know, the 3-point function, which is something you can imagine doing a lot easier than, maybe something else, right?
Yeah. Yeah, one thing that I do have to say is that for some of the bounds that derive, if you calculate the contribution to the FNL, it's actually quite large, like maybe a few hundred. But the only thing is that they localize in one of the, it should be localized in one K mode or like a very narrow window of the K mode. And for us, we don't know if there are existing bounds that can directly apply. So any of those tools would be very nice.
Yeah, but thanks. It was really interesting to hear about this.
Thank you. Yeah.
Anyone else?
I actually had another quick question, which was,
yes.
The inflationary post-processing, which effect does it have? Does it have the effect of taking all very many different models and making them all look the same? Or is it very sensitive to the initial sort of perturbations of like the coupling to the inflaton and whatnot? And so does it actually make a very sensitive probe of what was going on during inflation? I figure it's probably one of those two, and I'm just sort of curious if you guys have just sort of played with different models to see which one it is.
Yeah, good question. For the story I told you, like everything is only relates sensitive to the time dependence of the mass around the minimum.
I guess I was just wondering if you had different time dependences. Right, like you could imagine
that's right.
In your case, it was growing in time, but maybe it's constant, maybe it grows faster than linearly.
Yeah.
So, and do those all look the same or do they all look very, very different? And so could you actually—
No, I think they will definitely look different. So if you have a row into a minimal mass and say it becomes flat and stay for a long time for the mass term, you can imagine like a spot with several horizon sites can pump out. And if we produce too many of those, I don't even know how to think about the signal. It would be nearby horizons may generate some signals. So the only thing I say is that here we only do like if we do the linear expansion and saying the growth of the mass go in the linear around that T star, that would be this logarithmic profile. But I think for a different potential, it can be different. And also, even for the thing we say, we are only talking about the time very close to the production time. If you are looking at a very big spot, so that we can look into very central region of it, it's still like within the resolution of the experiment. I think the log profile will no longer work. And that will really depend on what's the later profile of the sigma. So that will be also be interesting to look at if we do have a very big horizon size of the spot. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
So is that the same as asking the question of how generic or how well you can constrain the generic mass dependence in your effect? Like, so you're using a quadratic dependence here, but if I had a more complicated...
I think there should be a way, yeah, we should do that. There should be a way like considering the reasonable resolution. So I can tell you like within this horizon size, because I cannot see things that that leave the horizon too late. Then within for that size of the structure, the profile is pretty much just this logarithmic profile. So in principle, we can say put a bounds on what's the horizon size that the log will always be a good approximation. So in that case, if it's a sigma squared, sigma to the fourth, or a different number, as long as I can always do an approximation expansion around the minimum, I start from the linear order. Wait, is that right? Yeah, I need to think more about this. Yeah, for the more non, yeah, there can be a different potential than the. Yeah, so it's basically the validity of the linear expansion around the minimum. If that's a good approximation, then the profile I told you is just look like that. Mm-hmm.
Any more questions? Well, if not, we can thank Yixin again. So thanks for a very nice talk.